Hare Krishna Go Gopinath Shyama Kunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana Ki Jai Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai Navadvip Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai Gangamaya Jamuna Devi Ki Jai Bhakti Devi Ki Jai Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharne Nivasesa Sunyavadi Paskachade Satarne. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Guru and Vaishnavamscha. Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Sam Sajivam. Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Deva Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamsha Vanchakapa Sri Vishak Kipasandavya Vata Patijanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavya Namaha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So this is a class being transmitted from Auckland, New Zealand on May 2nd, 2020, although I'm recording it on May 1st, 2020 in the United States. And it is from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 27, Verse 6. And this is the chapter Understanding Material Nature by Lord Kapila Dev. Yamadivir Yoga Patire Abhyasan Shradayan Vita Mai Bhavena Satchena Matkata Shravanena Cha Yamadivir Yoga Patire Abhyasan Sharavanvita Mai Bhavena Satchena Matkata Shravanena Cha Yama Adi Bihi. Beginning with Yama. Yoga Patai, by the yoga system. Abhyasan, practicing. Shraya Anvitaha, with great faith. Mai, unto me. Bhavena, with devotion. Satjena, unalloyed. Matkata, stories about me. Shravanena, by hearing. Cha, and. Srila Prabhupada's translation. One has to become faithful by practicing the controlling process of the yoga system and must elevate himself to the platform of unalloyed devotional service by chanting and hearing about me. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Yoga is practiced in 8 different stages. Yama, Niyama, Asana, Pranayama, Pratyahara, Dharana, Jnana and Samadhi. Yama and Niyama mean practicing the controlling process by following strict regulations, and Asana refers to the sitting postures. These help raise one to the standard of faithfulness in devotional service. The practice of yoga by physical exercise is not the ultimate goal. The real end is to concentrate and to control the mind and train oneself to be situated in faithful devotional service. And Srila Prabhupada is saying that because if we look up here at the verse, we see Shraddha Anvita, with great faith. Going on in the purport, Bhavena, or Bhava, is a very important factor in the practice of yoga or in any spiritual process. Bhava is explained in Bhagavad Gita 10.8, Buddha Bhava Samanvita. Let's go look at 10.8, which is one of the four main verses in the Bhagavad Gita. Aham sarvasya prabhava matya sarvam pravartate iti matvaha badante mam Buddha Bhava Samanvita. I am the source of all spiritual worlds. Everything emanates from me. The wise who perfectly know this engage in my devotional service and worship me with all their hearts. Bhava is explained in Bhagavad Gita 10.8, which we just read, Buddha Bhava Samanvitaha. One should be absorbed in the thought of love of Krishna. When one knows that Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is the source of everything, and that everything emanates from him, aham sarvasya prabhava, Bhagavad Gita 10.8, then one understands the Vedanta aphorism, janma jasya yataha, the original source of everything, and then he can become absorbed in bhava, or the preliminary stage of love of God. Rupa Goswami explains very nicely in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu how this bhava, or preliminary stage of love of God, is achieved. He states that one, first of all, has to become faithful, shradayan vitaha, which again is from today's verse. Faith is attained by controlling the senses, either by yoga practice, following the rules and regulations and practicing the sitting postures, or by engaging directly in bhakti yoga, as recommended in the previous verse. Of the 9 different items of bhakti yoga, the first and foremost is to chant and hear about the Lord. That is also mentioned here, matkata shravanena cha. One may come to the standard of faithfulness by following the rules and regulations of the yoga system, and the same goal can be achieved simply by chanting and hearing about the transcendental activities of the Lord. The word cha is significant. Bhakti yoga is direct, and the other process is indirect. But even if the indirect process is taken, there is no success unless one comes fully to the direct process of hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord. Therefore, the word satjena is used here. In this connection, Swami Sridhar comments that satjena means nikshapatena, without duplicity. The impersonalists are full of duplicity. Sometimes they pretend to execute devotional service, but their ultimate idea is to become one with the Supreme. This is duplicity, kapata. The Bhagavatam does not allow this duplicity. In the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, it is clearly stated, Paramo Niratranam, Bhagavatam 112. This treatise, Srimad Bhagavatam, is meant for those who are completely free from envy. The same point is again stressed here. Unless one is completely faithful to the Supreme Personality of Godhead and engages himself in the process of hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord, there is no possibility for liberation. Yamadibir yoga patar abhyasan shradayan vitaha mai bhavena satchena matkata shravanena cha. One has to become faithful by practicing the controlling processes of the yoga system and must elevate himself to the platform of unalloyed devotional service by chanting and hearing about me. Okay. Right. So, how to get liberated? That's the... We want a possibility of liberation. What we want to do is we want to get free. What does Prabhupada say in the first canto? The need of the soul is for full freedom. We want a liberation where we revive our original relationship with the Lord, where we are in Goloka Vrindavan, playing with the Lord, dancing with the Lord, eating with the Lord, serving the Lord. That's what we're looking for. And here we have 2 main points that are given emphasis by Srila Prabhupada. Actually, 3 we could say. One is Shraddha, to have faith. We have to have faith in order to attain bhava, and we do that by hearing and so forth about Krishna. So why is this so important? in order to get liberation from material illusion, we have to know what is the cause of material illusion. And the cause is a lack of faith and a lack of love. So we're missing Shraddha and we're missing Bhava. We don't really believe. What is it we don't believe? I mean, Prabhupada is referring here to Bhagavad Gita 10.8, right? What is it we don't believe? Aham Sarvasya Prabhupada. I am the source of everything, Krishna says. Everything emanates from me. We don't really believe that. We believe that we are the center. I believe that I am the doer, right? Ahankaravi mudhatma kartahaitmi ichimanyate. I am creating so many things. I'm working hard for things. It's my intelligence or my collective intelligence of my family, my race, my religious group, my country, human beings. We are the doers. You know, if there's God, he's not very important. We don't have this faith that Krishna is not only the controller, but we don't have the faith that he's the enjoyer, right? Bhaktiram Yagatapasam Sarvaloka Maheshwaram. We don't believe that things are meant for his pleasure. We're not convinced. We think, well, they're meant for my pleasure. So we don't believe that he's controlling everything. We don't believe that everything comes from him. We don't believe that everything is meant for him. We don't really believe that. We really believe that we are the center. And even religious people and spiritual people struggle with this on a deep level. And I remember, it was in 2006. I was sitting in a Govinda's restaurant in Delhi with a devotee who casually was quoting Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. You know, just having a casual conversation and just quoting Bhaktisiddhanta that Krishna is the transcendental autocrat. And Srila Prabhupada reads that in the recording about the Maha Mantra. And I could feel internally a resistance to that idea. As soon as this devotee said, yes, Krishna is the transcendental autocrat, just said very casually, we would say off the cuff. And immediately I felt a resistance. Why does he get to be an autocrat? I don't like autocrats. I like democracy. I don't want autocrats. I've been teaching the Gurukul kids here over Zoom about government, civics. We talked about different forms of government. I gave them the assignment of finding out different forms of government. I thought there were only, you know, like 5 or 6 forms. Evidently, there's about 40. But I don't like the idea that God is an autocrat. And it surprised me, you know, that I started practicing Krishna consciousness in 1972, 73. And here it was 2006, and I still had an internal resistance to the idea that God gets to decide what to do and how and when, and I don't really get to have much of a say in it. You know, there was we had a former president, George W. Bush, here in America, and at one point about something, I can't remember the context, and it's not important, he said, I'm the decider. So Krishna is saying, I'm the decider. I mean, he takes the devotee's wishes into consideration, but he's the decider. You know, when he wants to leave Vrindavan and go to Mathura, that's what he does. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu wants to go to South India, he just goes. The devotees are fainting on the road. You know, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is trying to stop him. And he just goes. When he wants to go to Vrindavan, he just goes. He's the decider. He's the controller. I can come to him and say, you know, please give me this, please give me this, and please do this, and he can say yes or he can say no. So it's not just that I resent that he's the decider. I don't really believe that he's a decider. I believe that I have a whole lot of say in what's going on. And, you know, there's also a lack of faithfulness, Surudam Sarvabhutanam, that he's good. because it seems to me that a lot of the things he decides are not very good. It seems to me that the things that happen to me and the things that happen to people I care about are not good. It seems to me that nasty people get positions of fame and power and wealth, and lovely people get positions of poverty and disease and so forth. And so I don't really agree with him being all good. And this is this skepticism. That is there really a God, and is God really in control, and, you know, is everything meant for his enjoyment? You know, I think it's meant for my enjoyment, right? I look around, I'm like, oh, what a nice world here for me to enjoy. So, you know, there's this skepticism, and because of this skepticism, I can't get liberated. I'm stuck in the modes of nature because I want to believe something that's false. You know, I want to believe something that's false. And liberation means that I'm going to be in the truth. Right? We have the word here also, satchena. Satchena. Which Prabhupada says is unalloyed in the word for word. And then he talks about how Sri Goswami says it's without duplicity. So this means that I'm worshiping Krishna, or I'm doing some spiritual process, because I actually believe, not just theoretically, not that I can just say, I believe that he's a God and he controls everything and he's the enjoyer and he's my friend. And not that I can just recite a catechism, but really I don't have a resistance to that. I have an acceptance. I'm embracing that on an emotional level, on a desire level, and an intellectual level in all ways. It's something I deeply, truly believe. You know, if I really believe something, I will do it. And this is true for all of us. When we say, I believe that, but I'm not doing it, it means that there's some problem with our belief system, that we haven't really integrated it. We're believing it just on some level. So faithfulness, to have real faithfulness, and then to have bhava, not just faithfulness, but love. Not just, yes, you're the controller, you're the enjoyer, you're my friend, but I love you. It's not like, okay, I believe you're the, but I don't really like it. I believe it and I'm following it because what else am I supposed to do? But I don't like it. But no, we actually have love. We actually have love. And that, again, this is the root of our conditioning, is I don't want to love Krishna. I envy him. I envy him. So Rukmini and I were looking earlier today at this quote from Bhaktivedanta Swami in his book Surrender, where he was saying, if you envy someone, you want to take what they have, and if you really envy them, you want them to be annihilated. You want them to go away. You want them dead, or if they don't die, you just want them to go away. You don't want to hear about them. You don't want anyone else to talk about them. You want them to just not exist. Right? So that's the opposite of love. And you see in this world that people, very often, they push God away. You know, even many religious people relegate God to a certain time or a certain place, or a certain time and place, certain activities, and the rest of the time, the rest of the places, the rest of the activities, you know, we're not allowed to talk about religion. Don't talk about religion. Don't talk about God. And this tendency to remove God from life is very dominant in the world today. That we're going to discuss, you know, this virus pandemic, we're going to discuss natural disasters, we're going to discuss medicine, we're going to discuss science, we're going to discuss math, philosophy, art, culture, and God is, leave God out of the conversation. So this is, it's envy. It's envy. Just, you know, I want to make him go away as much as possible. So we need to reverse these two things. So Srila Prabhupada talked about having a society of love and trust, and that's what we just talked about. Trust and love. And why both love and trust? You know, I have to believe that you know what you're doing and you care about me, both, in order to surrender to you. Right? If you just know what you're doing but you don't care about me, you may use your knowledge to hurt me. And if you care about me but you don't know what you're doing, you may, with good intentions, lead me down the wrong path. So I have to have faith that Krishna is God, and then I have to love Krishna. So how are we going to do this? And this particular verse of Kapiladeva is specifically about Dhyana Yoga or Astanga Yoga. But it's interesting that Jiva Goswami, in commenting on this verse, said it's about Gyan Mishra Bhakti and Karma Mishra Bhakti. So I found that kind of interesting. And I have a graph here that I'm going to go to. Some of the benefits of teaching class on Zoom. And I can just show you all these nifty things. Okay, we want a little higher than that. Do somewhere in between those. There we go. Perfect. Okay. So I made this particular graph based on Bhagavad Gita chapter 12, but it's very relevant to today's verse. And here you see with the yoga ladder going from Ugra Karma or Vikarma, sinful activities, to Karma Kanda or Karma or pious activities, to Karma Yoga or Akarma, to Gyan Yoga to Gyan Yoga. And then Bhakti is here on the right side. Now one can go directly from Karma Kanda to Karma Yoga or to Gyan Yoga. Pretty hard to go from Karma Kanda to Gyan Yoga because Gyan Yoga requires a tremendous amount of mental control even to start it. So let's look at how we get this faith. You'll notice that faith is involved here with moving from Karma Kanda or Ugra Karma to the beginning Angas of Bhakti. And faith is involved in Karma Yoga, Gyan Yoga, and Dhyan Yoga in moving to Abhyas Yoga. This is, I say, it's based on the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Abhyas Yoga basically is talking about getting into sadhana bhakti. And this word abhyas will go back to the verse. So if we look back at the verse, then we notice this word abhyasa, right? Abhyasa, practicing. So abhyasa literally means to repeat. Literally means to repeat something over and over again. Okay, so how does this work? Well, let's look at, if considering that although Lord Kapiladeva is speaking here apparently about Astanga Yoga, he uses the word yama, there's the yam niyam, and yam niyam, although it applies certainly to Dhyan Yoga or Astanga Yoga, it also very much applies to Karma Kanda or Karma Yoga. To do the right thing and not do the wrong thing. You know, to be a vegetarian, to not have illicit sex, you know, not gamble, and so forth. So those are, that's piety, and we find that right here. So this is piety. So piety can lead to a position of faith. Why does piety lead to a position of faith? Because when we're pious, we're happier. I mean, if we're doing, if we're in the mode of passion instead of the mode of ignorance, if we're in Rajagun instead of Tamagun, we are going to be happier. And when we're in Sattvagun instead of Rajagun, we are going to be happier. And what delineates these higher gunas are the laws of God. Dharmam tu sakshat bhagavat pranitam. What designates something as yam or niyam is the laws of God. And we find if we follow the laws of God, we're happier. And such research, we're happier, we're healthier. Such research is done a lot today in terms, unfortunately, of just Buddhism. and different meditation techniques, although a little bit about religions in general. But there's a lot of research that in general, obviously this doesn't apply to specific individuals, but in general, religious people are happier, healthier, live longer, and so forth. That if we do these practices, we're more peaceful, like Krishna says, we became Bhoktaram Yagatapasam Sarvalokamaheshwaram Suvridam Sarvabhutanam Gyatvamam Shantim Richati. And in the 12th chapter, he says in Karma Yoga, when you give up the results of your activities, one will find peace. Antim Shanti Kalevaram, one will find peace. This peace also gives one a lot of faith. It gives one a lot of faith that God exists and he's good. God exists and he's good. Then what about through Gyan? So through Gyan Yoga, we're not just interested in Gyan, but Gyan Yoga. So by Gyan Yoga, we study the section of the Bhagavatam deals a lot with Gyan, Samkhya Yoga. So we're studying the nature of reality. So Gyan means to study the scriptures directly. It also means to be a scientist, to study science, to study logic. Right? There's so many logical arguments for the existence of God and the goodness of God. We see, Prabhupada talked about this a lot with his disciples who were scientists, and of course we have Bhakti Swarup Damodar Maharaj, who wrote that book about Krishna consciousness, a small little book, The Scientific Basis for Krishna Consciousness, so that if we look at the world scientifically, we cannot but see the hand of an intelligent and loving creator. So Gyan gives one, again, that sense of faithfulness, that yes, there really is a God, and God is really the controller, God is really the enjoyer, and God is really the friend. Yes, so this gives us faith. It also gives us peace, because through Gyan Yoga, one becomes detached. And such is quite common that philosophers and scientists often, at least they feel themselves to sort of be above the fray. It doesn't always happen. We certainly have historically many very materialistic and hedonistic scientists and philosophers, undoubtedly. But that's the idea, that science and philosophy give one a sense of being not so involved in what people in general are running around trying to achieve. And then we have Jnana Yoga. So how does Jnana Yoga give one faith? So Prabhupada talks about in today's purport the asanas. So there's, of course, the pranayama and the asanas. And the purpose of the pranayama and the asanas are to make the mind peaceful. Srila Prabhupada talks about this in the Nectar Devotion, in the story of that poor brahmana who meditated every day on worshiping the Lord. He meditated on going to the Ganga personally, filling a golden pot with water. It's funny, as I'm saying this, I'm sitting right next to my altar, and so my deities have this little pot. It's silver, gold-plated. And so I was, this is the kind of pots, right? You see the ladies carrying India on their head. Of course, it's a lot bigger than this. But so I was looking at it and thinking, meditating on going to the Jamuna or the Ganga, whoops, and filling up the pot with water. But then I thought I'd probably meditate on filling up a lot bigger pot than this, not just this little thing that holds a few milliliters of water. So anyway, he's meditating on filling up these pots from the Ganga and the Jamuna. And like Prabhupada said, generally when we bathe the deities, we just say a mantra. Ganga cha Jamuna cheva Godavari Saraswati Namade Sinukharevi Jalesmin Sandini Kuru. Please, all the rivers enter into this water. But he in his meditation actually went to the rivers. And Prabhupada starts that discussion by saying that in order to enter into a meditative state, the brahmana was doing breathing exercises and sitting postures, and Srila Prabhupada says that in those days that people in general knew how to do this. So the human body is constituted in such a way, it's a machine, yantra rudani maya, it's a machine, and this body is made in such a way that if you just breathe a certain way, and you sit a certain way, your mental condition will change. And it's very interesting that a lot of people who have little or no interest in spirituality are discovering these facts. You know, if you just open your eyes wider or narrow your eyes, it changes your mental state. If you look up or you look down or you look to the sides, it changes your emotional and mental state. How fast one is breathing changes one's mental and emotional state. How one is sitting, what one's posture is, changes one's emotional and mental state. So our mental and emotional state affect our breathing, affect how we hold our body, it affect how we deal with our eyes. And conversely, how we deal with our breathing and our posture and our eyes and so forth affects our mental and emotional state. So I find it fascinating that modern medicine is exploring these kind of ideas, completely separate from any idea of self-realization or liberation. They're just trying to get people healthy. But they find that if they teach people breathing exercises, and, you know, it'll be a real simple thing. Okay, everybody sit like this, and let's just take a deep breath, and it has an effect on the whole nervous system, the circulatory system, and so forth, and so on. So the body is a machine, and it's designed by Krishna that if you breathe in a certain way, sit in a certain way, put your eyes in a certain way, and you do all those things, the mind will quiet. The mind will go peaceful, just like Srila Prabhupada said in today's verse. Let's see, what did he say? The real end is to concentrate and to control the mind and train oneself to be situated in faithful devotional service. So the mind gets concentrated and controlled just by certain mechanical processes. Now, if you do these mechanical processes properly, which is very difficult to do to a high level, so you can teach any average person, anyone who's even eating meat and drinking alcohol, you can teach anybody that if you slow down your breathing and you sit in a certain way, that your mind will become more peaceful. But if you want to really go to a depth of meditation, if you want to go to dharana and dhyan and all the way to samadhi, that requires the yam and niyam. That requires that one already live life in a particular way, and it requires a certain amount of mental strength that most people in 2020 just do not have. Something like, you know, we read in the Bhagavatam of these soldiers who had the strength of 10,000 elephants. Now, maybe there's a little hyperbole going on there, but just 100 years ago, there was this one guy, Clive, I think somebody, I can't remember his name. He had the strength of 4 draft horses. If any of you don't know what a draft horse is, you can look it up after the class. Some of you will probably go look it up right now. But anyway, they're huge animals. I mean, they're much, much bigger than ordinary horses, and they have very hairy feet. I'm just thinking, there's a king in a Bhagavatam called Romapad Maharaj. Prabhupada named a disciple Romapad Maharaj, which literally means hairy feet. But anyway, so these draft horses, sorry, Romapad Maharaj, if you're listening to this class, but these draft horses have very hairy feet, so at the back of their feet are these huge tufts of hair, and they're gargantuan horses, not only very tall, but very muscular, and they're used for heavy work. So there were these 4 draft horses, and he had 2 strapped to this arm and 2 strapped to this arm, and they were being whipped to pull him in different directions, and he had his arms like this, and 2 draft horses from this side and 2 draft horses from this side did not move his arms. He also, I think, pulled a railroad car uphill on some tracks with just his arms, so rather strong gentleman. And thousands of years ago, there were Kshatriyas who were as strong, not just as 4 draft horses, but as strong as 10,000 elephants. So they had that much physical strength, which very few people in 2020 have that kind of physical strength. And also, formerly, people had more mental strength. They had more ability to focus and concentrate their mind. So this Ashtanga yoga is not really very practical for most people. But if you do Ashtanga yoga right, you go to the higher levels of Ashtanga yoga, and the mind becomes very peaceful, you enter into a state of great bliss. And you feel a sense of connection with the Lord, which again gives one faith. Again, gives one faith. Now, how do we get faith directly in bhakti? How do we get faith directly from bhakti? As explained in today's verse, one is hearing. One is hearing. What does Lord Kapila Dev say? He says, Matkata Shravanena Cha. Matkata, to hear about me. We gain faith by hearing about Krishna from devotees. I mean, it's a very simple process. Krishna talks about this in the Bhagavad Gita in terms of the supersoul, that even those who don't see the supersoul or whatever, aren't experiencing the supersoul, can gain faith in him by hearing about him. We gain faith by hearing about all kinds of things. You know, I've never been to North Korea, probably will never go there, but I have faith that the country exists, and I have faith that, you know, it's run by this, what's it, Kim Jong-un, who has that funny haircut, who looks like a little Lego piece. Because, you know, I've heard about him. I've seen pictures of him, and I've heard about him. I mean, I don't know. I've never met him. I most likely never will meet him. But my faith is coming from hearing. Right? My faith is coming from hearing. Or I remember the first time that I was in Indonesia, maybe it was the second time, first or second time, and I was invited to the World Hindu Parishad meeting. It was the second time. And they had these big bowls of fruit that they were serving out at the World Hindu Parishad. And it was kind of this, looked like a kind of the same color as an eggplant. It was small and round. And I got a thick skin, and I peeled it, and there was this like white stuff in the middle that looked something like a tangerine. And I had one. I was like, wow, what is this? They said, oh, that's a mangosteen. They said, it's supposed to be the best fruit in the world. So hearing about the glories of this mangosteen, which, by the way, you can't generally buy out of the tropics, doesn't ship very well, it gave me faith just by hearing. You know, how fantastic this fruit was. So we're always learning things by hearing. You know, I mean, if I just looked at it, I would have just thought it was a ball. You know, you open it like this and you eat it like this and so forth. And then, of course, ultimately in all of these, we get experience. We talked about how in karma yoga, one gets peace and faith through detachment, and through becoming happy by following the laws of the Lord. In Jnana Yoga, also by a sense of peace and detachment. In Jnana, through peace and detachment. And in Bhakti, we also experience Kevalananda Kanda, even for a beginner in Bhakti Yoga. We get some sense here, you see, the beginner in Bhakti Yoga gets also some peace, a sense of peace, a sense of detachment, and some sense of happiness. Now, as Srila Prabhupada says in today's purport, that even those in Jnana Yoga, Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, those in the indirect path, have to come to Madhkata Shravanena, have to come to hearing about the Lord's glories. And they come to, as Kapila Dev says in today's verse, Abhyas Yoga. Abhyas Yoga is sadhana bhakti, where we're repeating, repeating, repeating. And from Abhyas Yoga, we get, as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Icha. We get a desire. In today's verse, it's using the word Bhava. So we're coming to preliminary love. We're coming to preliminary love. So this coming to preliminary love, how do we get Bhava? It's really only in bhakti. One has to switch over from Jnana Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Karma Yoga. At least one has to add bhakti, if not to switch over completely. And Jiva Goswami says that today's verse is really speaking about a mixture. It's really speaking about Jnana Mishra Bhakti or Karma Mishra Bhakti. But if I'm going to, I mean, it's almost circular reasoning to say if I'm going to love Krishna, I have to love Krishna. Because in Karma Yoga, I still have this sense of I'm the doer. You know, I'm so detached. I'm so peaceful by my efforts of giving up the fruits of my work. In Gyan Yoga, it's by my efforts at understanding. In Gyan Yoga, by my efforts at controlling this machine. Yes? So in Bhakti Yoga, though, we understand that it's not about any of that. In Bhakti Yoga, I understand that ultimately it's all grace or it's all mercy. Srila Prabhupada says that what he means by mercy is we ask for it. Please be merciful to me. And grace is something we get without asking. That's how Srila Prabhupada defines it. But that ultimately I'm going to get liberated. What is it? Daivyesha gunamayi mama maya durajya mam evaye prapadyante mayam etam tarantite. Taranti is to cross over. So ultimately this illusory energy, it's very difficult to overcome. Just trying to overcome it by karma yoga, gyan yoga, dhyan yoga, we're not really going to be able to do it, because the root of our entanglement is not a lack of piety. The root of our entanglement, you know, you can be a really pious, good person and be an atheist. There are lots of good, pious atheists. You know, it's not just about being a good person. And who's perfectly good anyway? Even King Riga had trouble being perfectly good. You know, it's practically speaking impossible. So we're not going to get out of this world by being perfectly good, nor by being perfectly wise, nor by being perfectly self-controlled, because that's not the problem. The problem isn't that we do bad things. As long as we're under the modes of nature, we're going to do bad things. The problem isn't that we're foolish. Again, as long as we're under the modes of nature, we're going to be foolish. The problem isn't that we're not completely self-controlled. As long as we're under the modes of nature, we're not going to be completely self-controlled. The problem, the reason that we're under the modes of nature in the first place, is this lack of faith and love in God. It's lack of a loving love and trust. It's lack of a love and trust relationship with God. And until we fix that, we're not fixed. So that's really what we want to achieve. And therefore, having faith and love in God is a lot more important than trying to be perfectly good or perfectly wise or perfectly self-controlled, none of which we're going to be able to do anyway. Because all of those set us up as the doer. And I'm not saying we shouldn't be good, and I'm not saying we shouldn't be wise, and I'm not saying we shouldn't be self-controlled. It's not that, you know, we should go around robbing stores, being a foolish person and saying and doing whatever comes into our mind. The rules of being good and being wise and being self-controlled are coming from Krishna. They please Krishna. But we're never going to be able to do those perfectly in conditioned life. It's just not going to happen. There's this quote where Prabhupada says, you know, none of us are perfect in following our Dharma. He said, neither you can be perfect, neither I can be perfect. And when we put our emphasis in karma yoga, gyan yoga, gyan yoga, in being perfectly good or perfectly wise or perfectly self-controlled, then in order to be happy, we have to imagine ourselves as being better and wiser and more self-controlled than we are. And we're always comparing ourselves to others. We're constantly in anxiety. It actually foments our sense of envy. We're always trying to convince Krishna that we're good and wise and self-controlled, and therefore we should earn our way back to Godhead and so forth. It's just a mess. What we really want to do is have faith and love. That's really what we want to do. And if we have faith and love, then we are good in the ultimate sense, even though we're still going to mess up things. And we are wise in the ultimate sense, even though we're still going to be foolish about some things, and we'll be self-controlled in the ultimate sense. You know, we find even the very great devotees, they sometimes do things that appear to be foolish or something like that. But because they have faith and love in Krishna, it doesn't matter. They are connected in yoga. So how reassuring that we can be connected in that way, just by falling in love with Krishna and believing in him. And it's so easy just by hearing about him. I mean, just like Srila Prabhupada put so much emphasis on his books, producing the books, you know, printing the books, reading the books, selling the books, talking about the books. Because the more we do that, the more we develop this faith and love. That's just... it's not that hard. You know, we give a Krishna book or a Bhagavad Gita to somebody, and within a few days, they can have enough faith in Krishna and enough love for Krishna that they change their whole life. Something that through karma yoga, jnana yoga, jnana yoga might take. What does the Krishna say? Bahunam janmanam mante, gyanamamam prapajate, vasudevam sarvamiti samahatma sudurlabaha. It might take lifetimes through the other indirect processes, but just by hearing about Krishna. As Prabhupada said, even a child can take part, even a dog can take part. Jananda Maharaj has a book about animals and Krishna consciousness. But we've certainly seen very young children, you know, very young children, 1.5, 2 years old, really, really young children, who can barely talk. And they have faith and love in Krishna just by hearing about him. I mean, it's not... why not? It's not a mystery. Krishna's wonderful. I mean, he's just wonderful. Well, what to say, you know? He's just what we would want God to be if we thought about it. You know, an eternal adolescent having parties in the forest without adult supervision. You know, isn't that what everybody wants? Doesn't everybody want to do that? To go to some beautiful place in nature? I mean, you can also have gorgeous buildings and fountains, and eat delicious food, and dance and sing all night, all day, and defeat horrific, grotesque, powerful monsters. And then come back to the elders and go, yeah, we had fun today. And have the elders not know everything that you did. I mean, isn't that what everybody wants? Isn't that what we all want? To kind of sneak and have some fun? That's sort of kind of not allowed. And to just be youthful and joyful and playful and free. And as we have these desires in us, they must be part of Krishna, as Prabhupada says today. And the Vedanta Sutra, everything's coming from Krishna. So when we hear that Krishna's like this, when we hear that God's not this, you know, old man with a business suit in the throne. Have you been good? Have you been bad? We become faithful. We're like, yeah, I want to worship a God like that. Yeah, I do. I want to worship this eternally youthful, playful God. I want to love him. And that desire, icha, that desire, leads to bhava, leads to love. And then liberation is like, Madhavendra Puri said, like a maidservant standing at the side with folded hands. Prabhupada talks about liberation in today's purport. But liberation becomes just a side thing. Right? Mamcha yoga, avicharina, bhakti yoga, and sevate, sagunan, samatit jaitam, brahma bhuyari kapate. It just becomes, okay, whatever. So, we have some time. Not much time, maybe we have some time for questions, comments, additions, subtractions. If anybody has any comments. You can type them in the chat or you can speak.
I just wanted to comment that when you were saying about, you know, sometimes devotees do things that aren't the most wise, and I was thinking of Nidura when he gave the banana peel.
Yes, that's a very, that's a very good example. Thank you. I mean, it's funny because Vidura was a very wise man. You know, he was the son of Vyasadeva, and he was a great scholar and learned person. He was one of the wisest people in the whole kingdom. And then he gives Krishna banana peels instead of the bananas. And you could say that was a foolish thing to do. But it's not necessary that devotees never do anything foolish. Even the gopis, Prabhupada says, how, you know, they put their clothes on upside down and inside out. Anybody else? You have about 5 minutes. Yes, Rukmini.
So earlier you mentioned that if we really believe something, then we would do it. Like,
yes.
If we don't do what we believe, then that signals some defect in our belief system, that at some level we don't completely believe it.
Yes.
And
at least that's my belief.
Yeah. Charles Saunders Peirce said that a belief is a rule for action. So,
oh.
Later in the class, then you were saying that, you know, being good or being wise or acting self-controlled, we will never do all of these things perfectly.
Correct.
So then, I mean, we
have
to... Oh,
so you're saying that there's a contradiction.
Right, that's the question.
Ah, that's what happens when I have Rukmini come to my classes. She finds all my logical contradictions. We won't do them perfectly for various reasons, but that's different from basically not doing them. Let's see if I can give a very simple example. So there was some time ago, I was taking prasadam and they were bringing out, the devotees brought out this very rich dessert. And I said, you know, this is really a delicious dessert, but please don't make this for me every day, otherwise I'll eat it and I'll gain weight that I don't want to gain. So one of the devotees there, who was considerably heavy, said, well, that sounds really hellish, that you can't just eat whatever you want because you don't want to be fat. And I said, no, it's not hellish. And I was thinking about it later, and I thought, you know, there's a lack of belief on the part of this person that they would be happier by not being fat. You know, they're actually happy the way they are. So because they don't believe it, therefore they don't want to live without pie every day. It was just kind of interesting to me. I thought, oh, they believe it's something wrong with it. Or I think of this with my diet. Like I was saying to some devotees, I've said this to a number of people, that I believe that being an ahimsa vegan, if I were a vegan and took only ahimsa milk products, would be a higher standard ethically than just being a vegetarian. And intellectually, I believe that. But I don't do that. So I will eat commercial milk products. You know, I'll purchase them myself, and I'll eat them at a temple or at a devotee's house. And if I really believe that it was a higher standard ethically, why don't I do it? And it's something that I've looked at over and over again. You know, I don't do it basically because of the same reasons meat eaters eat meat. In many cases, just social convenience. I don't want to have a special diet or say to my hosts, I can't eat this and I can't eat that. And I like cheese. And I don't like vegan cheese. And it's very hard to get ahimsa cheese. So, you know, there's things I like to eat. But that's what I realize. Those are exactly the same arguments that meat eaters make, where they say, I like to eat meat. Or, you know, I don't want to inconvenience my hosts. I don't want to have problems going to a restaurant. That my arguments aren't any better. And so I'm faced with the fact that I'm doing something that seems contradictory to what I intellectually believe to be true. So I must not fully believe it. There must be some level at which I don't believe that that would be far superior. Now, I see that's different from saying I can't be perfectly good. I can't be perfectly good. You know, we're going to inadvertently offend people no matter what we do. I mean, it just is what it is, what it is. As long as we're under the modes of nature, we're going to be motivated selfishly without realizing it, and so we're going to offend people like that. But even if we had pure motives, you know, Jed Barge is weaving the palanquin because he doesn't want to step on an ant. How can you avoid killing something? It's just not possible. I mean, I remember driving to Mangalartik one morning with a vehicle full of Gurukul kids. You know, it's dark, 4:30 in the morning, and we hear this thud, and this animal had run into the street. I did not see the creature at all. It ran right into the wheel and died. It was a mother raccoon, and there were all these baby raccoons, and the kids were crying, and I was crying, and it was really catastrophic. But how are you going to avoid that? How are you going to live and avoid? It's just not possible. And as long as we're to any extent under the modes of material nature, we will do things that are selfish. Even the good things we do will have selfish motives mixed in with them. They just will. And that's just kind of what it is. But that's very different from the deliberate choices that I make, saying I believe this, but I'm not going to do it. You know, it's really, I'm really fooling myself there, or trying to fool myself, because I don't fully believe it. If I really fully believed it, I would do it. If I really said this is really superior, then I would do it. But I must not believe that it is. I must believe that other things are more important to me. Therefore, those things I believe are more important to me, I consider them to be superior.
The difference between, you know, repeated and general versus accidental.
Yeah, that would be a good way to put it. But accidental, I would put in the category also of, you know, my motives are impure. And I'm not even aware of my impure motives. And so I'm causing harm to others because even the good things I'm doing from a wrong place without even being aware of it. So I would consider that an accidental. Accidental in the sense that I'm not saying, well, I'm just going to eat this or I'm just going to do that.
Thank you.
Did that make it? Did I pass the logical test there?
Thank you, that helps.
Okay. All right, well, I think it's 8:30 there in the morning in Auckland, so I think we have to end, and people can go to
question.
Their day of working remotely. Somebody else had a question? Oh, we have something in the chat. Okay, let's look at the chat. Oh, okay. Can meat eaters go back to Godhead? Can they achieve pure love of God? Well, Garuda can. Garuda's a meat eater, and he's in the spiritual world. It's actually kind of a difficult question, because Srila Prabhupada will often say that if you follow your particular religious system perfectly, and you can know and love God through your religious system, that religious system is perfect. And we know that there are religious systems in the world that allow some kind of meat eating. However, we will find that the meat eating allowed in those religious systems is very much like the meat eating allowed in the Vedas. That it's allowed as a concession, and it's allowed while telling people it's not good. So the Bible allows for meat eating, but it also says that any animal you kill, that you're going to be responsible for. And it says that God does not like the offerings of animals in sacrifice. So it is a very difficult question. It does seem that at a certain point of advancement in spirituality, one will come to the point that one doesn't want to cause harm to any other living entity unnecessarily, as a regular, deliberate action. And we find that people advanced in some level of God consciousness in any religious system generally become vegetarians at a certain point, even if their religious system as a whole is not practicing vegetarianism. So I think we can safely say that in order to attain pure love of God, one has to be kind to all living entities. It's something that's emphasized throughout the Shastra, not only our Shastra, but in every religious scripture that I'm aware of, all the main religious scriptures. Jesus said, you have to love God and you have to love your neighbor. Well, I think the animals are counted as our neighbors. Is it possible for somebody to attain spiritual realization without becoming a vegetarian? I don't know. I really don't know the answer to that. Is it absolutely 100% necessary? I don't know. I mean, we do know that people can become fully Krishna conscious in their last moment of life. So you may not have to have had a pious life. There's that story of a devotee whose mother, when she was dying, said, so now where is your Krishna? And Prabhupada said she went back to Godhead. You know, we have demons who were killed by the Lord and they attained, you know, like Pandraka to me is an incredible story. Pandraka goes to Vaikuntha. Or what about Putana? I mean, she wasn't just a meat eater, she was a baby eater, baby killer. I mean, so it's not that one has to be a vegetarian one's whole life or even a significant portion of one's life, but one could become God conscious, Krishna conscious at the very, very end of life. But assuming that when that happens, just like with Ajamil, he became aware of the Lord at what appeared to be the end of life, that he continued to live, and then in that continuing to live, he followed the principles of Bhakti Yoga. So I think we could safely assume that if somebody becomes fully Krishna conscious in their last moments of life, if they didn't at that point die, they would not continue to be a meat eater. But that doesn't mean that we should say, well, you know, let me eat hamburgers and figure that the Vishnu Dutas will come for me at the time of death because I'll name my kid Narayana. You know, that's... Then there's something wrong with the whole attitude there. So Ajamil did not have that mood, or that devotee's mother didn't have that mood. When we have that mood, then I'm going to kind of, you know, get around... That was Hiranyakashipu's idea. I'm going to get around the fact that Lord Brahma said I have to die. And okay, he got killed by the Lord, but it's not a very good policy to think like that. You know, it's sitting on the strength of chanting usually, and it doesn't make Krishna happy. It's really going against the whole principle of faithfulness and love. But we should definitely be careful about judging people in various religious systems. I mean, Srila Prabhupada said, if you're really a Christian, you won't eat meat. But when we're looking at individuals in various religious systems, we should be careful. It's up to Krishna to judge them as individuals. So we can say, as a principle, if you're really following Jesus, if you're really following the Bible, it's clear that a vegetarian diet is what God wants. We can say that. But when we look at individuals and what is their particular journey, how are they progressing, better to leave that to God in the heart. Better to let Him worry about that. I mean, we even see people coming to Krishna consciousness. I know some people, the first contact with Krishna consciousness, immediately they become a vegetarian. Other people take years. And, you know, different people struggle with different things. So some people never have illicit sex in their life, and other people, they're struggling with it, you know, 20 years into being a devotee. So it's... people go at their own pace and their own way, and they may realize things at different points in their trajectory, but it certainly isn't possible to love God without being kind to all living entities. You know, and we've got Garuda, though. You know, he's an interesting personality. He's definitely not a vegetarian. He eats snakes and fish. So if you can fly around the universe with God on your shoulders, then it's okay. You can eat fish. All right. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.